The American Buffalo and the Changing Colors of Fall in South Dakota. From SDPB, it's Friday, September 27th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, this is not the state of the 1970s. SDPB's Jackie Hendry and I spend some time in the shoulder season for South Dakota tourism. We'll explore the Custer Park Buffalo Roundup and Tatanka Day at Crazy Horse Memorial. Then SDPB's C.J. Keene gets his feet wet and his hands muddy alongside people working together for wilderness. We'll explore beaver dam analogs in the Black Hills. Our own Lee Strubinger takes to the canyon with the Spearfish Canyon Leaf Reporter. Plus, come fly with Tony DuBois and Alex Massa. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh.
Have you seen the real South Dakota?
That is a little historic audio from the South Dakota Department of Tourism asking you the burning question of whether or not you have seen enough of South Dakota. SDPB's host of South Dakota Focus is in the studio with me. Hey, Jackie Hendry.
Hi, Lori.
Have you seen South Dakota?
I've seen so much of South Dakota.
Much of South Dakota, and I love every bit of it.
Yes.
What are we listening to?
This is, this is some prime vintage come see South Dakota footage from the 70s. This might, frankly, even predate the Department of Tourism. At this point, might have been the South Dakota Highway Department or something. And that's just part of the history of things that I've discovered in going through this season of South Dakota Focus, looking at the tourism industry in South Dakota as, kind of as that storytelling marketing arm for the state, saying to everyone else, come here, come see what we've got going on. And the different ways that looks over time. I mean, a lot of us remember the Great Faces, Great Places song,
right?
And everything.
Yeah.
Kind of a fun little treat to go through some things like that and see how that has changed over time.
Have you seen the South Dakota that keeps alive the flame of hope that has stirred mankind for thousands of years in the beloved Passion Play? Have you seen the South Dakota of the past and the South Dakota of the future? The South Dakota that belongs to the nation, to free men everywhere. Mount Rushmore is only part of South Dakota now.
What do you notice about what we're talking about in the 70s versus what we're talking about today?
And it's so many of the same things, just in slightly different ways. So like when we talk about moving mountains, we have some old film reel footage of Korchak Joukovsky at Crazy Horse before there was so much as a face in it. It was vaguely a few blasts out of a mountain by this point in time. But we have this vision of what this will come to look like. We're seeing, we're celebrating the fishing, the hunting, the natural resources that we continue to celebrate today. So much hasn't changed, and yet so much has changed in how we celebrate and talk about the things that we hope people come to enjoy about South Dakota. And then, as things develop, different areas of the state develop even more. So, there are some things about, Sioux Falls that you don't see in this 1970s era celebration of South Dakota, and these things grow too.
I love this one.
Have you seen the South Dakota of man-made wonders? Giant dams providing thousands upon thousands of miles of shoreline and millions of kilowatts of electric power.
It seems quaint right now to think of a time where we thought a giant dam would be a reason to come to the South Dakota and look at what we have done.
Yeah.
And now we look at a much more complicated history of what we have done as well. When you're putting together this season of South Dakota Focus, how are you seeing again and again the complexities of the tourism industry surface in ways that people are wrestling with in thoughtful dialogue?
Well, for instance, when we look at this, you know, circa 1970s era film reel about all the attractions of South Dakota, we're looking at natural resources, we're looking at history, but when we touch on ideas of cultural heritage is one of the voiceovers that we hear. This is the moment when we see Native dancers in their regalia, and that is pretty much the context you see Indigenous people in South Dakota. That very specific, this is that opportunity to experience almost like a past image of culture. Versus today, we're seeing a much more, you know, modernized Indigenous people and tribes are having their own stake in the tourism economy. Tribal tourism is its own developing economy in sort of a separate situation or in tandem with the broader, that's a partnership that is ongoing with the broader tourism department. And we're seeing the first conference for tribal tourism in South Dakota happening a bit later this fall. That's an example I see of how things have shifted versus telling someone else's story versus the people involved in that story telling it themselves to visitors as they come through South Dakota.
Oh. Your early version of tourism in the state comes from traveling here in a road trip with your mom and dad, little Jackie Hendry in the back of the car in a Great American Road Trip. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, and it's funny because we're from Northern Illinois, so we just hop on 90 and clock our way through, ultimately going to Yellowstone, but we spend a few days in South Dakota along the way, and anymore we would probably stop in Sioux Falls for that first overnight. But when they first passed through Sioux Falls in the 80s, mom and dad from the interstate, they were like, oh, what is this place? And they kept moving. So my first overnight in South Dakota, not in my adopted hometown of Sioux Falls. In fact, we stayed in Mitchell. Got to see the world's only corn palace, of course.
Yeah, that's obviously not so bad. Yeah.
No. So a lot of affection for Mitchell, of course. And then from there, we move on into the Black Hills and Flatlander Jackie Hendry.
Yeah.
Had never seen anything like it before. I'm craning out the back seat of the Subaru, just in awe of what I was seeing. That was the first glimpse of mountains that I had ever seen in my life before. And just completely the smell of the pines and just something about the air. I don't know what it was, but it just really captured my imagination. And then, of course, you visit Mount Rushmore. And from Mount Rushmore, we went to Crazy Horse Memorial. For me, that was my first experience with Native peoples and cultures and histories in North America. And so that really captured my interest that never really went away and ultimately turned into me coming to South Dakota for school, starting a career here, and here we are. And it amazed me when I first came to school at USD from Illinois, and there were so many South Dakotan kids who, by college, had never left the state before. Yeah. And to me, that was so hard to imagine. But now, having lived here for a certain amount of time and seeing all that there is, like, I can see very easily how, you know, not only do you not see portions of your own state, but even beyond that. And so that's an exciting thing to be able to share that with folks in South Dakota through this job is, hey, did you know right over here, there's the incredible neutrino research happening underground in Lead and things like this that we get to look at.
Science tourism. Yeah. That was a new thing that you looked into for this season. Super fascinating stuff. You had a really great time at the Mammoth site in Hot Springs. What was there that lit you up?
Other than
the plush toy that you brought home.
You know, I will say I got a very cute woolly mammoth plush that I named Wolford Brimley. And if you've seen the episode by now, there's a bit of punnage in the investigation at the Mammoth site, which I encourage you to check out. We talk about this in the episode with the chief operating officer of the Mammoth site is, you know, Hot Springs, you're so close to all of the more traditional attractions like Custer State Park, like Mount Rushmore, but you're just far enough away that it's so easy to miss. And I'm a perfect example of that because I've been vacationing in the Black Hills with my parents since I was a teenager. I had never been to the Mammoth site until I went for this show.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting because, I mean, where I can't think of anywhere else, much less in South Dakota, these are real. You can look right there as actual paleontologists are uncovering the Ice Age mysteries right in front of you. And I just think that's so exciting. It's all right there for you.
All right. Today is the day of the great buffalo Roundup. And Jackie Hendry has the call, seated with Game Fish and Parks folks. What do you want people to know about this event and the way it's sort of captured the imagination of the world in some ways?
This has been a fascinating event to watch grow because I was talking with someone out in Custer State Park earlier this summer, and they were telling me it used to be, you know, the end of the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally was kind of the end of the peak tourist season. But anymore, it's after the Buffalo Roundup is actually the end. This has become such a unique draw. And so what we're looking at is, you know, private citizens helping with the annual roundup of around 1,300 buffalo in the Custer State Park herd to bring them together, kind of work through the herd, do all that, you know, nature maintenance of a buffalo herd that needs to happen to keep things healthy. But it's become such a unique thing. The governor's usually there. You have these riders on horseback directing an incredible herd of buffalo over the ridge and into where they need to go. And I'm told this is my first time ever attending.
Yeah.
So what a treat for me. But I'm told just the rumble in the air, you never really get over it. And that I'm hearing this from, you know, Jim Hagan, Secretary of Tourism. He says he's been to over a dozen of these, doesn't get over it.
The world's only buffalo roundup. Everyone in the neighborhood who can ride is invited to join with the park rangers.
We're going to hear a little bit of your interview with Jim Hagan here in a minute. You sat down with him. Were there surprises in the interview? What did you want to hear from him about tourism in the state right now?
I wanted to hear kind of how things are changing, because the great news about tourism is that there's a lot of great news. It seems like every year we're setting a new record about visitor spending. And these, in a large way, are a boon to South Dakota. But I really enjoyed hearing from Secretary Hagan some of the niche areas of tourism, some of the new partnerships that the Department of Tourism is wanting to build. But in the clip we're going to hear, he mainly is talking about how something like the Buffalo Roundup is kind of expanding that more traditional season.
It has been so much fun to see what we call our shoulder season just expand. And I think sometimes that shoulder season now almost feels as busy as it is during the peak season. So when I say shoulder season for your viewers, it really would be, you know, the end of August when school is starting again, and maybe you're seeing more retiree couples coming to the state, folks who don't have children in the home, but families too. We're seeing a lot of families. So, you know, September, October, even to the first part of November would be what we call our fall shoulder season. And that really is anchored by the Custer State Park Buffalo Roundup, unique in all the world, right? To round up 1,500 head of bison with real cowboys and cowgirls rumbling over the prairies of Custer State Park. That event, you know, is drawing easily 25,000 people a year now. And again, from around the globe. So I will call it our second global event, you know, after the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. We hosted someone last week in the state, a PR executive, who said, the Buffalo Roundup is really unique to your state. I can't think of another place I've ever heard of something similar or where this occurs. And so we really own it. And not only is it the Buffalo Roundup itself, but there's an arts festival that goes on as well for a couple of days preceding the Buffalo Roundup and after. Crazy Horse always does a fall Volksmarch at the memorial at that time. But it's a special event. And if you're a South Dakotan watching this, or if you're a non-South Dakotan and you have not experienced that Buffalo Roundup, I guarantee you it's going to take your breath away. The landscape is stunning, just the experience as a whole. You know, as it harkens back to kind of our Old West history and cowboys and cowgirls. I've been fortunate to attend probably, I don't know, Jackie, maybe 20 roundups, and I never tire of it. I'm as excited the next year to go as I am when I'm experiencing it in the current year. So you got to get there.
I'm Mary Martella, and I'm the Chief Development Officer here at Crazy Horse Memorial. We're really excited about this first ever, and hopefully now moving forward, annual event for us here at Crazy Horse Memorial, but also for the people here in the hills who come for this particular weekend. You know, of course, for years now at Custer State Park, there's been the annual Buffalo Roundup that's been very, very popular, and it's a lot of fun and, you know, a lot of sense of cowboys and, you know, that kind of activity around buffalo in the park. Until this year, we've not had the opportunity to really put together an intentional, thoughtful event in which we can look at the buffalo through the lens of what it meant to the people of the plains, to Native Americans here, and, you know, do that at the same time. So for folks who maybe have come for years or frequently, this gives them another option during that weekend to learn about buffalo, to kind of think upon what that animal has meant, not only to American history, but also to Native American culture. And the importance of it, not just in the past, but to today. And not only, you know, maybe through diet, but also through culture and values, storytelling, performance, and just really how central the buffalo has been to specific tribes within the Native American culture.
Yeah, I like what you said about today. Let's start there. What are some of the ways that this is an essential animal and an essential relationship?
Yeah, well, the buffalo represents a number of really important values in Native American culture, and in particular, the Oglala Lakota culture. And so, you know, like patience, perseverance. And so you see the buffalo in a lot of art. And even here at the memorial, you can see in our museum a number of art pieces that we have installed on display. And so from an artistic view, the importance of it, but also symbolically, and then just historically. So for example, we have an exhibit in the lower level of our cultural center, which will be a prominent item during the day. We're going to really encourage a lot of friends and visitors to visit that part of the memorial that often doesn't get quite as much activity or foot traffic. And so we have it's called the American Bison Exhibit. And so it talks more about the actual bison and where they were located and, you know, what happened to them. When we think about Native American art and culture, there are a number of pieces represented where buffalo, you know, whether it be paintings, sculpture, we have brought in a number of special culture bearers, whether they be performances or activities, ways in which visitors can engage and get more of the experiential enjoyment out of it. So for example, those who have been to the memorial before might know that we have a pretty large teepee prominently displayed within the museum. But we're gonna bring that outside onto the lawn and have storytelling outside by the teepee with one of our culture bearers, Daryl Redcloud in particular. And we'll have buffalo dancers, we'll have a buffalo box that has items related to buffalo in it and somebody with it to explain in utilizing buffalo that Native Americans really appreciated, that there was something you could do with every piece and every aspect. So, you know, whether it's from the practical and the tangible all the way to the symbolic and the spiritual, helping people see and having Native Americans in particular, but all people at the memorial share in this day with our visitors and help us all kind of lean in and take a deep dive on how central this animal has been to a culture and a way of people, both past and present.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. On a perfect September day, a few dozen passionate conservationists are installing beaver dam analogs, or BDAs. In a secluded corner of the Black Hills, it's a mission in water security, habitat maintenance, and environmental care. SDPB's C.J. Keene made the journey.
This is the sound of a group of conservationists becoming constructors.
Throw that bucket in.
In here.
Yeah.
That's from a beaver right there.
Doggone beaver.
Doggone beavers. Beaver chewed. I'm putting this in the BDA.
Beavers are a crucial part of the Black Hills ecosystem, but it hasn't always been an easy path for North America's largest rodent. Seen by some as a pest, beavers are ecological regulators and water professionals. Volunteer Hans Stevenson is leading the group and debriefs exactly what they're looking for as the day starts moving.
Wider stem sedge grasses down here. We want the sod from those, not from this kind of like brome, smaller.
The sedge is held better down than the other one.
Yeah,
right,
way better. Yeah. It so takes a lot of those. So what we can start doing while they're up getting pine is just above the site. So this line here, we want a group of people digging and cutting those blocks and just laying them over here so we can start building when they bring the pine in.
Yes, that is a dog whining in the background. Alongside us, four dogs are joining the job. Call them moral support. Put simply, we're in the middle of nowhere playing in the mud, but for a purpose. With each cut of sod and pull of the pine, we're building a structure that effectively functions as a beaver lodge in an area that desperately needs them. Imagine shingling your roof, but with blocks of mud and wood. It's work that was once done by beavers, which are now rare in the Black Hills. Steve Kozel is the Northern Hills District Ranger. He explains exactly what this effort will accomplish.
If you come back a month from now, 2 months from now, you're going to see a difference in terms of the water table. The grasses, the sedges are starting to expand. You really see some immediate results. Coming back next year, you're going to see changes in plant composition. Where it has been dry, you're going to see more water-loving plants such as your sedges.
That's important for maintaining stream flow in the interim, as beavers are only gradually being reinduced to the Black Hills ecosystem.
Reconnecting water with its previous water table. If you store it in shallow water tables adjacent to streams as we get into drier periods of the year, that will feed the stream and sustain stream flow for a much longer time than if the stream is not connected to its floodplain and riparian area.
And while you might feel like you're on dry land in the middle of the woods, doing just a little digging exposes that water table. Muddy waters up to your shins, possibly deeper, lying just beneath the surface, flowing through the earth. After mere minutes of digging, you can already hear the water trickling like any other surface stream. Beavers and their dams keep that water moving at a mid-deep level, and in turn, these analogs mimic their effects on the surface. That flow of water through beaver lodges, according to conservationist Chris Stover, is crucial for our livelihood in the Black Hills.
Water quality, quantity, and security. The more water that we can retain on the landscape, the more water will continue to flow into Pactola throughout the year. And that's water security, man. The amount of water that they can hold back on the landscape is immeasurable. It really comes down to water security for Rapid City and for the Black Hills.
Stover advocates for the reintroduction of many animals to the Black Hills, especially the beaver.
They work harder than we do, and they work more than just for one weekend a month. Right now, the population is way, way, way down. Hopefully, we can help jumpstart that if we can create a little bit of habitat for them, you know, and maybe we'll give them a little bit better place to live so that way they can move in and go, hey, this isn't such a bad place, right?
However, one of today's hardest working volunteers is Lori Brown. Covered in mud from nose to toes, she also might be having the most fun.
I think for me, working in conservation, but then coming out here on a Saturday, it really helps me feel continually inspired by the community that we have here. This work is a community effort, really. No one person or one entity could do this alone.
To that point, Brown, who is the Nature Conservancy's West River Riparian Health Program Manager, just needs to look around. Along with National Forest Rangers, Stover is with the Black Hills Fly Fishers. The National Wild Turkey Federation is here, and all of the Black Hills National Forest districts are present. Truly, anybody interested in conservation as a career or hobby can connect at these kinds of events.
Kind of puts me in awe of all the people that care about our water and our watersheds.
People like 67-year-old Randy Gaskin with the National Wild Turkey Federation. He says while they're building BDAs, today is about far more than the humble beaver.
Water is important for all wildlife. Whether you're talking the elk, the deer, the turkeys, songbirds, and insects. Insects need moisture, and insects are important, even if we cuss them at times.
But Gaskins and his group, with an average age in the 60s today, had some concern for the future.
It's just getting harder and harder to get young people involved in any of the conservation groups. And if conservation is going to continue, we need recruits. We need people to get involved. It may be working on a committee helping raise money, or it may be coming up and giving up a day to do a project. This is just as important. This is a wonderful opportunity.
All the conservation groups in attendance had the same message. Anyone, regardless of age or experience, can get involved somehow at these events. It all begins with personally reaching out. I'm SDPB's CJ Keene on the Minnesota Ridge in the Black Hills.
In another part of the Black Hills in Spearfish Canyon, leaves are nearing their peak fall colors. SDPB's Lee Strubinger joined the official Canyon Leaf Reporter for a tour in the canyon. He brings us this story.
Kimberly Talcott inspects a bull thistle with a Canon Rebel near Maurice Intake.
What I think is so beautiful, right, is there's some that are purple, some that are kind of brownish here. The under part is like yellows and greens. They're thorny. They're kind of telling us not to get too close, but you can't help it because they're actually quite beautiful.
It's about 9 a.m. and the canyon is crisp. Dew covers the foliage near the banks of Spearfish Creek. A dragonfly hovers over rushing water. Talcott's the official leaf reporter for Spearfish Canyon. She's been doing it for 5 years. When Talcott's not reporting on the canyon in the fall, she spends her time as a grant writer. Maurice Intake is one of Talcott's first stops on her way up and down the canyon to determine what percentage fall colors are at. A fall color drive or hike or fishing excursion is a must as the canyon transitions from summer into fall. The biological diversity along the creek is immense. We take a couple more steps and stumble upon forget-me-nots.
They're just so beautiful. Usually there's like some moss around them and stuff. I've tried to get pictures of them all year, and I usually like end up stepping in water. But it's worth it because they're so delicate and sweet. These yellow ones are tansy. Kind of past their peak now. They're like a bright yellow right in the early part of September. Shall we gather on?
Sure.
Any other questions? Okay.
We leave Maurice Intake and get into Talcott's vehicle, heading towards Savoy. Jerry Boyer was the Spearfish Canyon Leaf Reporter for 30 years prior to Talcott. He's offered her mentorship on leaf reporting. One recommendation is to drive slow and to not miss any nuance of the changing season. As we wind our way south, passing Victoria's Tower, Talcott points to the yellowing dogwood shrubs, the bright reds of sumac and poison ivy.
Beautiful understory colors coming through.
It's around here that Talcott notices a shade of green up on exposed limestone cliffs in the canyon.
So I feel as we're getting deeper into the canyon, we're seeing more colors now. I think higher elevations can sometimes change earlier. It's cooler up there. And so kind of the science behind the leaves changing, right, is our days are getting shorter. It's less daylight hours. And so it's signaling to the leaves to start stopping that process of creating the chlorophyll, which makes them green. And then the true colors of them, which are the yellows, in this case the golden yellows, are starting to emerge.
Talcott says temperature, moisture, and wind also play a role for fall colors in the canyon. Even more yellows appear rolling past Iron Creek Trailhead and up through Savoy. Once we reach Cheyenne Crossing, I'm anxious to know what percentage Talcott sees the canyon at. But our journey is only halfway through. She says the way back down is just as important for determination. It's a different time of day and perspective on the canyon. We stop at a lookout near Savoy. The breeze catches leaves of a birch tree near the road. The temperature starts to rise and traffic increases. Talcott says her favorite time of day in the canyon is either the early morning or late afternoon evening.
That's the time it's quietest with, you know, other people. And so the wildlife tends to come out more during that time. It's cooler. I like the cool weather a little more.
For Talcott, that quietness and calm allow her to sit in nature and become part of the canyon. Toward the end of the drive, near the Devil's Bathtub Trailhead, I ask her about the role of stillness in a place like here.
there's so much to see. But something that's really helped me, and I challenge others too, is to just stake your feet in the ground and capture your attention on something and focus it, and you'll see more than you would in just a passing glance. And I think that kind of reflects on, you know, culturally, there's so many inputs, you know, with the technology and just especially this time, you know, the election coming up, there's just so much inputs, start of the school year, that it's a nice time to focus on the output of what nature is showing us.
Talcott says leaf progression in the canyon is slow, but at a certain point, it will be at peak colors, the foliage bright and beautiful. She says that change takes time, occurring day by day. Just like change in our own lives, she says nature reflects that process. We reach the parking lot at the bottom of the canyon, and I have one final question for the Spearfish Canyon leaf reporter. Okay, so we've driven both up and down the canyon.
Yes.
What's your verdict?
I think we are at 65% towards peak color change today. This is Friday, September 20th at noon.
And if you were to peer into your crystal ball a week from today, when this will air on the 27th,
I think around the 27th, we should be closer to peak. That's all I can say, Lee. I can't predict. There's too many factors at play. It'll be beautiful, though.
That is a guarantee.
Absolutely.
I'm SDPB's Lee Strubinger in Spearfish.
If you need booze, some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly.
That's the voice of a new resident in the Black Hills. Jazz pianist Tony DeBlois. He weighed less than 2 pounds at birth, became blind in the first week of his life, and was later diagnosed with savant syndrome. That's a phenomenon where someone with a mental impairment shows exceptional skills in another domain. For DeBlois, that's music. Now, you can hear Tony DeBlois play live Friday, October 4th in Bacon Park in Rapid City. He'll perform with trumpeter Alex Massa and the South Dakota Jazz Orchestra. The concert is called Come Fly With Me, a Frank Sinatra tribute concert. You can find tickets online. Massa and DeBlois stop by SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Alex Massa had heard about a new musician in town who wanted to learn how to compose. Massa met him in DeBlois' living room.
This gentleman, Tony, started telling me about all of his accomplishments and everything. And I was like, wait. I don't want to hear about your accomplishments. I want to hear you play. And so we went to the piano, and Tony started playing, and I was speechless. And he said he learns everything by ear, so I started putting tunes into his ear, and he would pick up everything I played. At the end of this little back and forth, I put Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet overture onto my phone, and I put it in his ear, and Tony listened for about 20 seconds without hesitation, played every single part of the orchestra back to me, and then started improvising on Tchaikovsky. And That was our first meeting, and I said, Tony, there's nothing I can do for you except to get you work.
To get you on the stage.
Yeah.
Tony, you live in the Black Hills now?
Yes.
And tell me a little bit about you started playing music.
At the age of 2 years old, I started going out and taking piano lessons at 5. I started playing nursing homes at 9. Now we go out and do solo concerts all over the world. And I just love my first time doing my Frank Sinatra show.
Do you have a favorite song? Do you have songs that you... That
all
you...
of me. Why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you?
Thank you. I love that. Alex, what's it like to work with Tony?
It really is just pure joy. The first time we played together was on stage down here in downtown Rapid City last summer. We didn't rehearse, and I just sent Tony a set list. His mom, Jan, gave me a call and was wondering what key we wanted to do this one song in. Yeah. And we went and we hit it, and there was just I don't know how to describe it, but I think my favorite thing about playing with Tony is that he is unmoved by mistakes, whether something happens with the rest of the band or as happens with almost every single singer, sometimes you forget a lyric here or there, but it doesn't bother Tony. He just keeps on going like a true seasoned professional.
Tony, what do you like about the Black Hills?
I finally got a camper. I got a camper van. So we're going to be traveling, doing shows in a camper.
Does everything fit in the camper?
What do you have? I love the camper.
What do you have?
It's like a
in?
House on wheels. it's like owning my second home. I got a kitchen. I got a bedroom. I got a sink and a shower.
Do you have a piano, Tony?
Yep. I got a keyboard in the camper to practice on for my Sinatra show.
All right, Alex, tell us about the show itself. Who all is showing up?
So we have of course Tony, who is our featured guest for the evening, and yeah. Backed by an 18-piece big band.
16-piece band.
Well, we have 4 trumpets, 4 trombones, 5 saxes. We have a guitarist, a bassist, an auxiliary keyboardist, and a drummer. And I will be doubling on trumpet and directing the band.
Wow.
All the musicians are local here to the Black Hills, except for one of the trombonists who is driving in from Sioux Falls for this performance.
And are you playing all Frank?
All Frank Sinatra that Tony is singing on.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the really cool thing about Frank Sinatra's music, and he brought this up multiple times, were the arrangers and the composers. And so a lot of songs that we're taking for this performance, Come Fly With Me, are the exact arrangements that he played in 1966 at the Sands in Las Vegas under the direction of Quincy Jones with the Count Basie Orchestra. To pay homage to that, you know, in that performance, there were some instrumental tunes that Basie would throw in, and I only thought it appropriate to throw some extra Basie numbers in there.
Tony, do you like Basie?
I love the Count Basie band.
Yeah.
We found it on YouTube, and I learned it off YouTube.
How long did that take?
3 weeks.
Do you like surprising people with how talented you are?
Yeah. And ladies and gentlemen, please welcome my mom, Janice DeBlois.
Is she in?
Hi, Lori. I'm here.
Hi.
She's also my manager and my roadie and my producer.
Hi, Janice. Welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here. Are you a Frank Sinatra fan?
I have always been a Frank Sinatra fan.
And a Tony fan. What's it been like to watch him grow as a musician and as an adult?
It's truly amazing. Even today, he surprises me with the things that he does.
Yeah.
And Tony never learned to have conversational speech until after he was at Berklee College of Music. In fact, when he went to Berklee, Tony does not read or write. Their first question to me was, how are we going to grade him? And I said, it's simple. You hook his keyboard up to a computer. Your teachers need to ask questions in such a way that he can demonstrate his knowledge of music. And he gained conversational speech while he was there and graduated magna cum laude.
Congratulations on that.
On Mother's Day.
Yes, on Mother's
Day. On Mother's
Day.
Tony, will you sing a little more Frank for us before we go?
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you need some exotic boo, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly.
That Frank Sinatra tribute concert is next Friday, October 4th, Bacon Park in Rapid City. Tickets are available online.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away.
And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you from all of us at SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh, and we thank you for listening.